Hello. It's good to talk to you. I'm Eben Moglen, and this is the beginning of Computers, Privacy, and the Constitution, a course which cannot be correctly described in our catalog because some bad computer program requires the name of a class to be too short to include all three words, computers, privacy, and the Constitution, and so the Constitution gets left out and substituted for by the more indistinct law. I'll try a little later today to give you an indication of what the difference is between law and the Constitution. But for the moment, let me say more that those who are continuing in this sequence of thinking from last term will now understand that our role here is to consider the relations between governments and their citizens and other inhabitants of their territories in the age of the internet society and in the presence of the parasite with the mind of God. For those who are beginning here the journey at what for me and for some of the other students is the halfway point, I will try today and next week to provide a brief summary of the ideas which generated themselves or at any rate caused me to inflict them on other people in the fall course, Law and the Internet Society. But this is a freestanding offering. And its nature is to be best summarized, I think, in the idea that everything is changing. And among the things that everything is many different versions of the power of the state. For those of us, and now I'm speaking not of a class, but of a movement, for those of us who have devoted ourselves since we were children to the idea of technological freedom as necessary to the preservation of civil liberty in the 21st century, who see ourselves as persons trying to maintain the fight for freedom of thought, which has been going on for 1,000 years, for those of us who came to the digital technology when it was new-ish, and in a moment I shall describe how new-ish it was when I came aboard it, for those of us who have therefore decades of experience with the role of software, computers, and the communications networks they construct, in our thinking about society, there was once upon a time a hope that the nature of this technology could be ultimately liberating. We hoped that it would secure broad freedom of a kind which was available only in a relatively acceptable form, in our view, to a very small proportion of the people in the world, and which could be used broadly to achieve the goals of freedom of thought and freedom of human self-development, which, as I say, we felt that we had inherited from generations who had struggled before us. The political meaning of the technology which I began working with when I was a child was at least in aspiration the meaning of freedom and liberty and a revolution against ignorance and want. But that is not the condition in which we find ourselves nearly a quarter of the way into the 21st century. Though many of the technological and structural properties of a network for human betterment that we felt ourselves to be founding, creating, working on from the beginning have come to be, and some fundamental innovations in the law of all of this, which I personally cared very much about and worked very hard to bring about, have happened, have swept, in fact, the board and are the ways that the law relates to the making of software in the world these days. Now, for all of that, no one could possibly say that the power of the state is actually weakened in the world in which we live. For all that states themselves, like many other forms of social institution, are under dismembering transformation at the moment, the reality of human despotism and disregard for the civil liberties of humankind, those realities have only deepened, and the perfection of despotism is now at least as likely an outcome of the adoption of digital technology as the perfection of human liberty. When I started teaching this course in 1997, that danger was utterly invisible to my colleagues, who had no idea whatever why such a course should exist. Or, to be fair, to most of my students who thought it was a side seminar, though many of the lawyers who came to work in the industries of software and intelligence who passed through Columbia Law School wound up sitting in it, it was still a small thing. This no longer is the way it looks. Because whatever else is true, people have become aware that the nature of the changes in technology and in society that flow from it are now a ground of contest everywhere between private power and the personalities it minds, which is the purpose of my full course to inquire into, but also because it is evident that the principles which have governed the conversation about the relationship between citizens and the state have themselves come under transformative broadening and depend upon technological understandings which the public as a whole does not have, and which have in incoherence and destabilization risked the obliteration of principles upon which at least the most fortunate portion of the human race have come in the last couple of hundred years to depend. The purpose of this course, then, is to consider the relations between those technological and social changes and certain fundamental principles organizing the relation between the state and the people. Those include questions of surveillance in the order keeping, the criminal law, the national security law, and so on, of the various powerful states in the world. And the principles of freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom to read, freedom from government coercion in the process of self-development and self-formation. The principles which govern the balance of power between the state and citizens when they are at odds in the courts, including but not limited to the process of criminal adjudication. And the overarching goal of understanding how we can have governmental systems which are both flexible to the possibilities offered to us by radical social change produced by the adoption of powerful new technology, and on the other hand, sufficient stability in expectations and norms and procedures and rules of self-understanding on both sides of the line between the citizen and the state, which have tentatively and uneasily, but with powerful consequences for the spirit of humankind, governed in some societies, in some places, between the late 18th century and 5 minutes ago. I need, before talking further about the substantive nature of our inquiry together, to talk first about methods and procedures. The world in which we are not meeting one another, in which we do not sit together in a room, in which our conversation cannot occur by moving air molecules from mouth to ear and virus particles from esophagus to nose, the world in which we do not meet is part of, but only part of, what makes our course distinctive in its process and understanding. For the purposes of a course that does not meet, the forms in which I taught before the epidemic began, supplemented by some new forms which are necessary in order to deal with our prolonged absence from one another, all join into a pedagogy which begins, as almost everything in the 21st century begins, in technologies of the World Wide Web, that wonderful invention of Tim Berners-Lee, which was actually the invention of the forgotten polymath genius Ted Nelson, who invented the idea of hypertext in the latter half of the 20th century, but never mind. We all take for granted now that there is a form of human informational exchange capable of being operated in an infinite flexibility of two-way structures, as a result of which half a dozen corporations own the principles of control over the human mind, but they needn't. The idea of the wiki, that is to say, a form of interlinked web pages that everybody can edit, which my colleague and friend and client and comrade Richard Stallman first described in the last quarter of the 20th century as the universal encyclopedia that everyone can collaborate to make, and which my friend and colleague and comrade Jimmy Wales turned into Wikipedia 20 years ago, the principle of the wiki, which is the principle of collaborative tools within the web, is the principle of the binding of this course, as you now have begun, I hope, by reading in our wiki to comprehend. What we read here, what we write here, what we say here is joined together in a world in which all you need to do is go up onto the upper right-hand corner of the browser page and either press edit to change what there is or new topic to make something that didn't exist before. Here is where the most important process of depositing our knowledge for one another, like spies dead-dropping files in a bamboo scaffolding in Hong Kong, here is where we make our way towards something that constitutes an improvement in all of our knowledge, joining everything we know to get to the things we wish we understood. The formal work in this course goes in the wiki. It is two essays that you will write on topics you will choose, each of which will be in at least two drafts. The principle of legal writing is, well, as a very good litigator I worked with once upon a time used to say to all his clients every time a draft of anything was distributed, every word will change. The principle of legal writing is iterative improvement, which means that the most important skill in legal writing is editing, which is complicated because law school barely touches upon the subject, never teaches it, and almost never rewards for it. Yet learning how to edit yourself, learning how to work with others to edit what you and they have done, is for the success of your activity and practice the most important skill you'll bring to your writing, and I am foolish enough to think that therefore law school should engage with it. So everything that we write that's going to be of any value to us, we're going to write together and we're going to write again. In particular, as I say, with regard to the formal work of the course, you will write two essays, never more than 1,000 words. If the draft is longer than 1,000 words, it isn't a draft. Never more than 1,000 words, two essays of your own choosing. It's the questions that are as important as the answers. So they're not my questions, they're your questions. And you will put them in the wiki. You can make them private to only you and me if you want to, but generally speaking, it is good for all of us to read and see and understand everything that's going on. But whether you make your essay private only to you and me or public to the group, I will comment upon it and you will rewrite it and I'll comment upon rewriting and we'll go on. The artificial structure of the semester and the grade, which is imposed upon us by the foolishness of school, we can ignore. Though probably you won't. Once you have a grade, you'll probably stop working on the writing, and there's probably nothing I can do about that. But as far as I'm concerned, the relationship that the writing establishes between us, you and me, thinking about something you have chosen to think about and trying to write down an idea so it gets better, that goes on for as long as you care to work. But two revisions, that is the first draft and a second draft after commenting, at a minimum, there must be. If you look in the wiki under archived material, you can find several hundred essays of that kind. And by looking at the history of each page, because every page in a wiki has a history, which includes all the things that have ever happened on it. So when we change a page, we're changing it, but we're not obliterating what was underneath. It's not a palimpsest like a medieval manuscript. It's a structured versioned file system, as the programmers would say. And everything we have, we keep. We just keep making it better without ever eliminating where we came from. But you can find a lot of student work in the archived material of the wiki, and you can see what I said and what the people who were writing said about what I wrote and what they did with it and so on, ad nauseam, I suspect, and if not infinitum, at any rate, fairly deep. It's drafts all the way down. And this writing, which is, as I say, the formal graded work in the course, is supplemented by other work, which I also take very seriously and also take into consideration, of two other kinds. When there is something you would like to discuss, maybe it came up on the etherpad in the course of our weekly simultaneously written dialogue, which substitutes for our moment in the classroom. Maybe something came up on the etherpad and you dropped it into a new page in the wiki and wrote something about it and put a comment box and other people started commenting and pretty soon there was a thread and after a while the thread got refactored, that is summarized and condensed and made more usable. Whatever happened on the pad or you thought it up or it was suggested by the reading or it fell out of something that I said in one of these recorded talks, you press new topic, you give the topic the name of the thing we're going to be dealing with, the topic of the topic. You put whatever you want to put, you put a comment box, and everybody goes to town. That's also part of how we deal with the fact that we do not see one another. We can run as many conversations together as we like. Then there is the journal that I asked you to create, which is a dialogue only with me. Each journal is an entity that passes back and forth between you and me. I see as you see overnight who has changed what, and then we can talk about your learning there. If there are questions that people should discuss, they can go in the wiki or they can be put on the pad or they can arise in a discussion group of a kind we'll come to in a moment. But if it is just a question of how I could help you better to learn more and to enjoy learning more, then the journal is a good place for it. There you will tell me how you came through this class in whatever way you like, in diary-like segments, in occasional outbursts of rage or satisfaction, or in whatever other way you want. I don't care the structure to reflect some expectations of my own. I'd rather that it reflected your experience. That's what a journal is. So you keep a journal, and I do want you to keep it. That is, I want you to do something with it. I don't want it to lie fallow completely, because the more I know about how your learning is going, the better it is for you and me in that conjoint process. Which we take for granted when we can all see one another's faces, and which we have to think about in a somewhat more deliberative way when we are spread across the world and all the time zones and all the environments, the rooms, the places, the different forms of human life, which in the epidemic have shattered our consistent expectation of how learning works. In addition to all the forms that there are in the wiki, the reading there, the formal writing there, the discussion threads or topics that you have made there, and the journal you are keeping there, we have the shared pad upon which every Tuesday afternoon for 2 hours everybody's eyes will be on the same set of evolving text, and everybody's fingers will be contributing to the making of the record of the things we wanted to talk about. The pad allows us, in return for not being in the same room together and not having the sense of simultaneous gathering that a class affords, the pad gives us an opportunity to pursue in parallel, in real time, 6 or 7 conversations about whatever it is that matters to you or matters to me. I'll get there early and put up on the board what I think the subjects of conversation might want to be, and then you'll change them as you see fit. And in our dialogue on that pad in 2 hours, some real-time evolution of what people care about can occur. Questions can be asked, and then we can take them to the wiki and mull them over further, or process can be proposed, or ways of making it better for you to learn, or questions can be asked, or brickbats can be thrown at me, or whatever it is. That on any particular afternoon, any Tuesday, that is, over the next 12 weeks, it seems to you like we ought to do. That's not the way a class operates in the world we've left behind temporarily. In a class, everything happens sequentially, and there's really only one thing being talked about at a time, and it's the job of the orchestrator down the front teaching the class to try and keep that sequentiality and immediate comprehensibility together. But that's not what happens when the disease shatters space and time and the virus reorganizes human civilization even faster than the internet. So there in the pad we have one form of communion available to us in our distanced modes. We will have the opportunity to meet face-to-face, masks over faces, in Riverside Park, outdoors, where the virus has more trouble getting to us, in another couple of weeks. For those who don't happen to be on Manhattan Island, which is not really the best of all possible places to be under current circumstances, I say this on my 312th day, isolated from the rest of Manhattan in my apartment, in my isolation booth overlooking the Hudson River and the park in which I played when I was a child. We shall meet there if we can and if you want to. There will be weekly sign-up sheets after a bit, but also some small group meetings through the net. I hope that you have read the essay on why not video conferencing, why I don't teach classes by video conference. I've been a user of video conferencing since the late 20th century, and I do not like it. If it were up to me, I'm not sure that I would suggest even better or at least freer video conferencing for small group discussions, but students have grown very dependent upon this unrealistic form of not actually being in touch, and it is important to demonstrate that it ought not to be Zoom. We shall have a lot of occasions to think about the things that things like Zoom do wrong over the next 12 weeks. Let's just begin by pointing out that Zoom is a centralized video conferencing service for which there is no actual technical necessity, controlled by a company which is a public U.S. company, but deeply intermixed with the forms of IT consolidation in civil society, without civil society, which are important to the Chinese state. You may have seen on the radar in this course some information about the criminal prosecution in the United States of a Zoom executive in China who was violating, according to the United States government, the privacy of Chinese American citizens and others, hoping to use video conferencing to memorialize the massacre at Tiananmen protest and memorialization crucial to the existence of freedom of thought, and which Zoom, under the pressure of Chinese state law, was hoping to prevent by facilitating spying on Americans. You understand that there is in the Chinese state an extraterritorial a principle of application of its new national security law in Hong Kong and also in its national security requirements for corporate cooperation with Chinese government. And you understand that Columbia Law School, where subjects are sometimes discussed in a way that the government of the People's Republic of China might not like, is now using Zoom and running its classes through an infrastructure which is highly permeable to Chinese state intelligence, let us say. None of that is acceptable to me. We shall see, as we think about questions of freedom of expression, freedom of reading, and freedom of thought in the course of this course, the more worked out, if I can't say, more convincing basis upon which I would offer arguments on this subject. So let me here for today, in the middle of what is actually just a secondary subject, make a statement of assertion. Freedom of thought is impossible without preserving the privacy of students and the anonymity of reading. This means, among other things, not allowing state authority of any kind or unnecessary intervention of private power in the process of teaching, in what is said between students and teachers. Columbia Law School doesn't give a fig about this. Columbia University doesn't give a fig about this. American higher education has abandoned any concern with the privacy of its students or the anonymity of reading under the pressure of the virus, which it shouldn't have done. Everything we do in this course that uses computers, whether it's the wiki or the pad or the readings or the video conferences that we use only for small group meetings, everything that we do in this course that uses computers I control. I don't mean computers I sort of control that somebody else controls. I mean computers I control, with one exception. The network of 16 nodes, physical servers, virtual machines, web servers, the cloud, if we want to use the contemporary term, which we are using to provide the services which facilitate our communications and our learning, with the exception of one physical node hosting one virtual machine in a virtual personal server farm run by Linode under Newark Airport, which is there in order to be the one place outside my physical environment. Every other node in this cloud is run by me. It sits on hardware that in most cases I built from loose parts with my own hands. It runs in every case free software, that is software licensed in ways that I've had a large part in devising over the last 2.5 decades that can be copied, modified, and redistributed freely by all users. That software was installed by me, customized by me, administered by me. It does what we want it to do, and it responds to the proposition that safety of our, the integrity of learning, the preservation of our data, the maintenance of our secrecy with respect to everybody else is the primary operating fundamental objective of the system. This will therefore include, if you allow me to close that long parenthesis, the way that we will see and talk to one another in small groups from time to time, not on a Zoom server, but on meet.moglen.us, that is to say, on a thing I made. The purpose of using the technology in this way is, as I say, primarily to protect your freedom. The freedom of learning under processes that are not, as all Canvas-delivered courses at Columbia University are, surveilled and analyzed by third parties. The freedom to evict other people's secret police and to keep them out as best I can, which isn't as good as it should be, but it's better than nothing. The freedom to pursue our activities knowing that learning is a process designed to create free minds, and free minds cannot exist where an overbearing state proposes even to know, let alone to punish, who is thinking dangerous or forbidden thoughts. But another purpose of this technology used this way is to prove what is possible. Yes, as I shall show in a minute, I might not be the average law professor when it comes to my relationship to computing, or the average law student, for that matter. But the possibility that all the services we need and which we currently acquire from the data mining giants with their favorable relations to this or that government, and the government data mining giants that exist wherever they are allowed to go, they're not necessary. The technologies of daily life, which we have come to call convenient or indispensable or absolutely necessary to the pursuit of a happy life, the services we require, we do not have to get by dealing with people who spy on us. This is crucially important. In the fight against despotism, despotism's best argument is always resistance is futile. You might as well give up before you begin. You need us, and therefore you need to live with what we need from you. If that's true, then this would have to be a course in why civil liberties will ultimately perish. But it isn't true. And in order to prove that we can continue to think the way we've thought for the past 1,000 years about freedom of thought, it will in the end be necessary to demonstrate that it doesn't interfere with ordering your cheeseburgers. So therefore, it becomes valuable not merely as a way of protecting your current learning, but of proving the most important of all things to learn. Freedom begins with the understanding that another future is possible. And so another part of the point of the mechanism here is to prove that another future is possible. And I don't mean possible in the broad sense that we have conjoined to social possibility since in the world of the 1520s, Thomas More first thought about the possibility of perfectible human society in the book he called Nowhere, Utopia, which came in every one of the European and North American languages of the North American languages of European descent to be the word we use to describe the perfectibility of the human future, always speaking about nowhere. But that's not the kind of future I mean. I mean the kind of future which is here now in prototype, proof of concept, running code, the things you can do. If we don't need Zoom because we have Jitsi Meet and Big Blue Button and other free software for optimized video conferencing in education that anybody can run, if we don't need to have Canvas because we can make wikis of our own, if we can communicate in all the plethora of flexible ways that we need in order to try to conduct higher education under conditions of the epidemic, if all of that can be done on small computers that we own and run for ourselves, then there is a very different world already in existence sitting next to the world that may be scaring the bejesus out of us. And that, too, is part of the mechanism of this course. In its wisdom, with respect to the epidemic still not under control, the university has created a schedule for the spring semester which is useless to you. 14 weeks compressed to 12, a week of studying for exams compressed to a single day. This is obviously ridiculous, as so many of the principles of supposed university operation in the midst of the epidemic are absurd. I will attempt, as I always do, to break the sequence of that time in order to make the semester a more flexible concept, but notwithstanding everything that we do, everything else you are doing will have to conjoin itself to this absurd schedule. So, we will write two essays in this class. First drafts will occur during weeks 3 to 12 of the semester. I will attempt to get comments back on everything that is written here within 10 days of the due date of the first draft of the essays. I'm not sure that's going to work. It's difficult to teach two courses a term under epidemic conditions, and I've always taught two courses a term since 33 years ago, so I can't be sure, but I hope I have adapted my living, sleeping, and attention schedules to the needs of two courses under epidemic conditions, having done it in the fall poorly. And at any rate, my goal is that you should have nothing but rewriting left to do when we come to the end of the 12-week term. Thereafter, well, I don't need any portion of your one day of reading period because there's no reading for exams because there's no exam. And I presume that most people will wish to wait until late in the exam sequence to complete their rewriting. We will pay close attention to the arrival of the grade due date after we get a little bit further along in this course, and you can begin to lay out in your own diary how you forecast the schedule of your work. But my fundamental assumption is that we will take a detour around the not even truncated, just fundamentally Potemkinized reading period, and that we will try and stay out of your way during the unduly pressed and insanely restructured so-called exam period. Those are, I think, the things I need to say about the mechanism of this course, except that I am reluctantly compelled to discuss the non-existent subject of grades. I hope that you have already evaluation policy. Those who have been through one iteration of the course in the fall in Law and the Internet Society will have some more hands-on experience with the non-existent subject of grades as I perceive them. But let me just summarize the portion of the evaluation policy most important to you. The three things that sensible academic evaluation measures, in my opinion, are effort, commitment, and improvement. Effort is, of course, inherent in the writing and rewriting of something you have chosen to do for yourself because it needed to be done. And commitment is measured, of course, in how deeply you needed something to be done, what you brought to it yourself, what concerns, intentions, skills, capabilities, understandings you welded together in order to make something happen that was your learning and that was useful or valuable or provocative or learning-inducing to your readers. And then there's improvement, which is the most important, numerically speaking, of these qualities being measured. Improvement, because it is so important to the grade, would best be achieved by writing really bad first drafts. Of course, writing really bad first drafts is a crucially important part of being an excellent legal writer. The bad first draft is the hardest thing to do. Once you have a bad first draft, anything can be improved. Once you know how to edit and you have a bad first draft, you have an excellent product some distance away. I joke with my law partner that in when the time comes for something to be said about our work at my funeral, it will need to be said that ours was an unusual law practice because in that law practice, Eben, who was in theory the guy at the top of the letterhead, wrote more of the first drafts than anybody else. And this is true. I mean, my practice, whether we think of it as the Software Freedom Law Center or Moglen and Associates or Eben over the course of his lifetime, my practice is a teaching practice. I have always worked with my students, and Software Freedom Law Center was designed as a school to work a prototype of a kind of organization that I wish more existed of around the great law schools of the United States. But as a teaching practice, it has always been a place in which I did a bunch of the first drafts. And they're not any good. I mean, they're good enough for first drafts, and then we make them better. You would, if you were a purely strategic thinker, you would therefore write absolutely terrible first drafts in this course and gain the overwhelming benefit of immense improvement when the second draft was, after all, really very, very good indeed, having started from a really bad first draft. That would be the obvious strategic way to succeed, and you won't do it anyway. Because the very idea of writing and turning in a bad draft, you see, it's antithetical to all the fear of failure and the insistence upon overachievement which has brought you to the, well, I can't say where we are together because we aren't anywhere together, but it has brought you to the willingness to go deeply into debt to be not here with me in law school right now. Yet again, I only wish to point out that if you were a perfect strategic thinker, you would write very bad first drafts. I dare you. I double dare. Indeed, I encourage you. But that won't work either. All right, so there we are about the about this course part. And there will be infinite time for questions everywhere on wikis, in journals, on pads, at meetings, in office hours, as you please, in which to clarify those matters. Now, with that behind us for the term, perhaps we could go back to thinking a little bit about what this course is about. Computers, well, I've said something about computers. Let me say just a little bit more. The first non-military digital computer in the world was delivered to the United States Bureau of Standards, National Bureau of Standards, in the summer of 1946. And we can, for practical purposes then, locate that as the moment of the Big Bang. In the same way that the cosmologists spend a whole lot more time on the first 10 nanoseconds of the universe than on the subsequent 2 or 3 billion years, we could try and split the hair on the Big Bang and go back as far as John Bardeen's invention of the transistor, but let us say that for these purposes, the delivery to the U.S. National Bureau of Standards in 1946 of the first non-military digital computer is the moment at which computing entered human society. I wasn't there. That was 13 years before I was born, and a full quarter of a century before I started working with computers in society, which I did in 1971 when I was 12. In 1973, when I was 14, I got a job as a commercial computer programmer with an operation called Scientific Timesharing Corporation. And I worked as a programmer and eventually as a designer and developer of computer programming languages, that is, a person whose primary interest was in the linguistic nature of the relationship between human beings and computers, through my childhood and out the other end. In 1979, when I was an undergraduate, I changed jobs and went to work at IBM in the Santa Teresa Laboratory in San Jose, California. And there I worked with a fellow named Mike Montalbano, now unfortunately long gone, who had been working at the National Bureau of Standards in 1946 when that first a civilian digital computer was delivered. In my relationship with Mike then, I can say that I was one degree of separation from the Big Bang. At the time, I went to work at IBM designing and implementing computer programming languages. I was one of a few tens of thousands of people in the world working full-time to develop mainframe computer programs for the manufacturers of those computers, of which there were some 100,000 such machines in the world, connected by a total of zero networks of networks. Well, that's not quite right. 0.5 networks of networks. The year in 1975, in which I and a colleague at Scientific Timesharing named John Gilmore, who later founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation with two of our other friends, and who made two substantial fortunes in the IT industry. John and I and a third fellow, Andy K. Dickey, were in the summer of 1975 writing what we believe is the world's first networked email distribution program at Scientific Timesharing. And one of our other friends, one of my other friends, a high school colleague, Lee Parks, was in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, working on a thing called the ARPANET. That is the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Project Agency's project for networking networks designed to keep the United States safe in the conditions of nuclear war, or really to keep the U.S. military safe in conditions of nuclear war, which came to be called the Internet, and which is now the external nervous system of the human race. So in that period, in the middle 1970s, when some of the basic technical structures that grew up in petri dishes and then took over the human world, when some of those structures were just coming into existence, I was one of the kids inside them. We didn't need no stinking badges back then. John was a 19-year-old hippie runaway, and I was a 16-year-old kid living in a comfortable suburban life with my lefty intellectual parents, and it got bigger after that. So I'm not going to argue by authority anymore about computers in this class. I've said the only thing I'm going to say sustained solely on the way to personal authority, which is I've been doing this a long time, 50 years and now almost. since I first began making things happen with computers using words. And so the phenomenon that has overtaken the human race, often being driven by people who knew that everybody else didn't understand it as well as they did, thank you, Mr. Zuckerberg. The phenomenon that overtook the human race didn't overtake us. We grew up inside it. This is the world that we knew was coming and that we hoped deeply with all our souls to change. Time when I was 15 in 1974, I said to my father once, in the 21st century, there will be two kinds of people, the people who know how to change the behavior of computers and the people who don't. And the people who don't will be slaves to the people who do. This disturbed my father, but it didn't freak him out. What freaked him out was the day I said to him, I have two brains now, one of them made of carbon and one of them made of silicon. And they work together so long as the one made of carbon controls the one made of silicon. That freaked him out. But indeed, there were lessons of my childhood at the beginning of this world in which we live. And so I grew up as a lawyer, as a historian, as a guy who did other kinds of things as well, with an eye on what we will be talking about. We will read together scraps of how this world came to be, stretched over a couple of decades, but I will stretch further back, and we'll try, in that sense, to bring context to technology, as well as detail. One of the things that we shall see in the course of this course, and which those who have been working with me in the fall have already seen, is that it is my conviction that in order to understand the problems, the issues, the solutions, the fears, the doubts, and the trenches where the bodies will be buried, we need to think at all times along three lines: technology, law, and politics. There is no way to get rid of any one of those three without the stool falling over. We cannot treat these as lawyers' matters or technologists' matters or politicians' matters. We have to understand them from all three perspectives all the time, consiliently. That is, allowing our understandings to overlap and to reinforce one another. With respect to the part which is technology, my insistence will be that somebody needs to really understand it. I will be, at most times, the default must really understand it guy, because I've been standing on this spot a long time. And I didn't have to learn it from the top down as you do. I learned it from the bottom up. And lots of it I built, and lots of it I run, and everything we do remains within the reach of what can be understood from where I am. But that doesn't mean that those of you who have technical skill, I won't expect to employ it. I will. Your understanding, your grasp of detail, your refusal to accept hype and bullshit are an important part of this course, and I hope you will be using those skills and spreading them about. Privacy. Well, we shall spend a little time defining privacy, not this week, but next. And we shall try and understand analytically what it means to think about privacy, as those who have been through my full course may already have done, or at least were subjected to my tedious attempts to help them do. But for the moment, let us say that privacy is both a legal and a technical concept, as well as a political one. We are trying to understand, when we talk about privacy, what the scope of the relationship between the individual and the state may be. Where is that, to be precise about it, which the state may not attribute to or treat as its own? Privacy is, in that sense, from a political point of view, the antithesis of a world in which the state has everywhere its own. In the 20th century, we called a form of political organization in which the state recognizes no boundaries to the scope of its authority totalitarianism. Not a bad concept. It wasn't invented in the 20th century, and as we talk about the first part of the Snowden lectures, we can see how in the fall of 2013, in the midst of what then seemed like a great public controversy, I tried to sketch the history of that idea. But let us say at any rate that for our purposes, the very notion, the sign, privacy, means, begins from, and ultimately is the epitome of the idea that there are limits, hard conceptual limits, to that which can ever be within the purview of the state. This is in a country like the United States, where a sort of casual libertarianism is barstool politics, unsurprising. In other portions of the world, including that which is the second greatest of economies and barely by a hair still the largest of human societies, the People's Republic of China, it isn't barstool politics, it's, well, confinable disorder. Making troubles, picking quarrels, subverting national security. Advocating disorder and instability. But that's privacy, a concept which has technical analogs we shall be thinking about from week to week, and which is embodied in laws and policies of staggeringly misleading and unimportant valence. Privacy is in law often a word meaning something quite different from anything we would use it for, and sometimes that's deliberate misleading, and sometimes that's a key to a creative understanding. Why, for example, the United States Supreme Court thinks of the word privacy as about such matters as contraception and abortion. The Constitution. The word left out by the law school registrar who thinks that law alone is sufficient to describe what I mean, and it is not. The Constitution. This course is Computers, Privacy, and the Constitution, because Constitution, that is, the structuring we give to power in government in its relations to other governments and the state, and civil liberty, which, at least in the American tradition, and you know, if you feel like extending it back to 1215, the Englishman won't bother with you, and if you feel like pushing it back to 850, the Icelander won't worry too much about it. But freedom in that sense, the liberty in civil society, the ways in which we are, as Justice Douglas put it in Doe and Bolton, the companion to Roe Against Wade, the freedom to walk, loaf, and stroll. The freedom which, as Harry Blackmun said in the dissent in Bowers Against Hardwick, quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., the freedom to be different that is not limited to things that do not matter very much. Those are the spheres of Constitution. This course is about Constitution, and Constitution is politics unrolling itself in history. And I, of course, on the other side of my various, you know, piles of intellectual disorder, I'm a historian. While I was working at the Santa Teresa Laboratory and at IBM's Yorktown Research Center on computer programming languages and studying law at Yale Law School, I was also getting a PhD in American history. And I have worked as a legal historian writing about commercial arbitration in 18th century America and the privilege against self-incrimination in Anglo-American criminal law and the nature of the roots of American defamation and judicial independence and, oh, God knows, all sorts of things along the way. And though it might seem that the course in computers and privacy wouldn't have a lot to do with the 18th century, a course in computers, privacy, and the Constitution does. And so I shall attempt to indicate the nature of particularly American constitutional principles or understandings in historical structure, also for the purpose of casting light upon the 21st century institutions, not only of the United States of America, but of countries elsewhere in the world, societies which have no share in our legal history and which are in no way part of the American constitutional order. This isn't a course in comparative constitutional law, computers and privacy. It's a course in computers and privacy and the constitutional problems which we have faced and will face. And whether that involves the tragic failure of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the place in which we begin with part four of our inquiry in a couple of weeks, or whether it is the more hopeful possibilities of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, that is, the part one that follows part four in our understanding of these issues, or whether it is part 6 or 9 or 14, its jumping off point will be the United States Constitution and the political and legal history that lies behind it, always for the purpose of providing insight into the contemporary structures of technology, politics, and law, which are our fate as we struggle over computers and privacy and our constitutions, whichever ones those might be. This, then, is the method, if you like, of the course, both as a technical matter and as an intellectual one. But still, that doesn't say exactly what's the course. Here's the course. We have built, in this network of networks, in this set of systems of services, in this trillion sensor universe of connected communications and pocket spy satellites and data mining service mongers, we have built a new extraskeletal nervous system which embraces the whole human race. In the next generation, by the middle of the 21st century, every human mind will be formed from birth to death in direct connection to the net. This structure of the network is an independent element in the anatomy of human society, external to all of us and yet ultimately constitutive of all of us. Our doing, our being, our evolving, our reproducing, and our thinking will occur in relation to that net and will therefore be in forms that never existed before the net itself existed. As important to the evolution of human society as the adoption of multicellularity was for life on Earth sometime back before the Cambrian explosion 550 million years ago. This adoption of the extraskeletal species-wide network changes who we are and what it means to be and how we think. But most importantly, it changes how we teach one another. The human race is what it is because of our ability to teach one another. Our growing biological dominance of the planet, our overspreading the surface of the earth, our ultimately coming into a power we did not comprehend or wisely use to destroy all life and to change the nature of the planet itself, all of that flows from our ability to teach one another. The network changes how we teach. And it therefore changes how we govern ourselves. Our intention here is to understand at the very beginning of a process that will last exactly one lifetime what those changes will mean for the underlying values which have for the last 500 years dominated some portion of the world's society. Those ideas begin with a form of humanism which expresses the individual as the primary unit of social, intellectual, and theological development. The soul in its relation to God, as established by the Protestant Reformation. The individual in relation to his and then her, and then we can hope our social betterment, which begins in that 16th century structure of St. Thomas More and carries itself through Francis Bacon and on into the scientific revolution and its effect on human welfare. And ultimately, the belief in the possibility of self-government, a form of democracy available not merely for a city, a little polis, a wall around a world, but to the whole of the human world, to every man and woman, and one hopes, child in due course. Which came also to stand for an idea of universal education, which the net might make perfectible, in which every brain on earth gets to learn whatever it wants to learn, regardless of its ability to pay or of the whims of government. This, that form of ideal of human society, now depends upon how we operate that extraskeletal nervous system, which never was there before and which contains within it the power to transmute all various human possibilities. But only one lifetime will see the difference between the most that could be accomplished in the direction of freedom and the most that could be accomplished in the direction of despotism. Only one lifetime. And that lifetime is yours. As one of my friends says about that world in which Lee Parks and I and John Gilmore and he himself were working to begin the building of the internet, as Dan Geer says, this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. So the choice, what does that mean? It is about that choice and why people have to know that it is there, and why people have to understand what choice is being made and how it's being constructed and how it either is or isn't constructed by them. It's about that choice that this course centers. It's also about that urgency, that this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice, and self-governing societies cannot make that choice unless the people in them know what the choice is and what it is about that motivated Edward Snowden to conduct the quite extraordinary career of espionage within the system of the United States, system of espionage, that led him to Hong Kong and then to Moscow in the summer of 2013. I asked you to begin the course by reading one or another form of my Snowden lectures given in the fall of 2013, Snowden and the Future, partly to raise a form of structuring the issues, and partly to reflect our human quandary, which began in my human quandary in the summer of 2013. We'll talk again in the next 10 days. I'll talk next Tuesday, and I'm sure it will come up in our conversations both this week and next about what I had to say about Snowden and the future. There are many other ways to think about what happened, and many reasons now, as events, particularly between 2016 and the day before yesterday, have worked themselves out, to consider yet more deeply part of the question I was raising that fall, which had to do with what Edward Snowden's politics are. Not as a matter of who he would vote for if he weren't in Moscow, where there's nobody to vote for, but about what his immensely courageous and deeply risky personal activity meant. What the idea is of being a citizen in a Jeffersonian republic, which Snowden was exemplifying. And I would prefer to allow some of that to arise in our conversation, as it would if we were in a room together now, rather than by my declaring, as though in need of further explication, what it was that I had in mind back then. The documents speak for themselves, particularly, I suppose, the video of my speaking for myself. I was much affected in that moment by an idea which came once upon a time to a predecessor of mine named Henry David Thoreau, who found himself in the summer of 1859 compelled to speak to the people of Concord, Massachusetts about John Brown. The point at which I found myself at the border of the United States in July of 2013, speaking to a border guard who wanted to know whether I had been to Iceland or not, a subject we'll talk about again next time. But the form in which I found myself relating to all the problems that I had been working on for decades was a form that was defined by Edward Snowden's willingness to risk his life. It was his life that he was risking. As a comrade of mine who had worked long in the near neighborhood of Mr. Snowden's activity inside the United States government, as an encryption expert in the U.S. defense industry, said to me that fall in a face-to-face conversation in a hard-to-listen-to place, he said, you know, I told my kids, from the moment that Ed Snowden took that first document, he knew that if they found him, they would kill him. He knew that. And I said, yeah, I think so too. And my colleague said, and you know, he just went to work day after day, took more documents. No, I said, he didn't just go to work day after day taking more documents. He went to work day after day at the National Security Agency taking more documents, wearing an EFF sweatshirt. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we just looked at one another across the table, and we smiled in awe, and maybe even pride, in the fact that that was the coolness, the irony of Edward Snowden. In the informal talks I gave around the Snowden lectures, I said that my view was, in the fall of 2013, that Mr. Snowden was destined to a kind of fame among people who were then in their tweens. Because, after all, it turned out that Edward Snowden bore an uncanny physical resemblance to Harry Potter. I meant, of course, to Mr. Daniel Radcliffe's Harry Potter in the films. And when I said this, people smiled, they laughed, they had a moment of recognition. And then, I guess it must have been in 14 sometime, around the time that Alan Rusbridger was so kind as to let me publish 10,000 words of the Snowden lectures in The Guardian on the front page of the paper. Edward Snowden gave an interview from Moscow to Vanity Fair, which was illustrated by a couple of wonderful photographs taken of him in the Kremlin in those extraordinarily well-lit mahogany rooms with all that smoky light of the late Russian afternoon day. And underneath one of the photographs, Snowden had written as a caption, "Very Harry Potter." And I thought, you know everything, don't you, about this? You understand who you were becoming as you went every day to spy on behalf of humanity on the NSA wearing an EFF shirt. Later, Forbes magazine published a set of interviews with, reported stories based on interviews with Snowden's co-workers in Hawaii. And they spoke glowingly of his skill. The reason that Ed had all the responsibility he had around here was just how good he was at his job. And how sweet he was as a human being, and how he had gifts for his co-workers all the time, and how easygoing and pleasant he was. And they said when he wore that EFF sweatshirt to work, we thought he was joking. And I thought, yep, you are the greatest spy in all of the history of espionage I know. You are the most extraordinary agent that there is, and you were self-recruited to the cause of everybody. A spy for humanity. It didn't turn out that what Snowden wanted to do got done, and that's why, in addition to how things looked when the lectures were given in 2014, I want also to think about what it looks like now in 2020. What happened, what didn't happen, what happened in response, where we really are now. Because actually, that's the key to understanding the technical and a portion of the political side of the problem that we begin now to face together. So if you haven't finished reading the lectures, or if you only read the Guardian version and you've got time left for the longer form, this week and next we will discuss where we now are. Where is the world in which we live? What are the powers and possibilities of the state? What is the willingness of the most important states on earth to pursue those objectives and the possibilities? And from there, we will pass on to our first part, part four, to think about the problems of surveillance, search, and seizure in their constitutional dimensions, from the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, onward and outward and downward to a very dark condition. But things will improve thereafter. There is light as well as dark in this story, and there are a million shades of gray. And most importantly, there is the fact that this is the issue of your generation. I wish it were the only such issue of your generation. There's also the climate of the Earth and the future of the planet. And those are the two great problems of the time. Even in the midst of the epidemic, those are still the two great problems of the time. But this is one. And there's a good deal that we can learn about it. And learning changes us. Because every revolution begins in someone's mind. Talk to you soon.